Hello and welcome to TV Break, the PopBreak.com's monthly roundup of all the ins and outs in the world of TV. I am PopBreak podcasting director Alex Marcus, and joining me today, as always, is editor-in-chief of the PopBreak.com, Bill Botkin. How are you today, Bill?
You know, sometimes my brain feels like Bill Burr and Taylor Tomlinson are just having a street fight in my brain, and today I'm glad to bring that ruckus right to the TV Break podcast.
Bill, you've never said anything more relatable on this podcast. Thank you so much for that contribution. Speaking of relatable things, also with us today, taking a break from helping Hillary Clinton with her Twitter account after that tweet about Barbie's Oscar snub did not go over well, it's Pop Break podcasting all-star Josh Chernacki. How are you today, Josh?
I honestly don't understand that reference at all. I'm not on Twitter, so I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah. It was that bad that it got around to me. And this month, we have a jam-packed show for you, including a review of Griselda, the new Netflix miniseries from the creators of Narcos and Modern Family's Sofia Vergara. Also, we're going to be talking about our thoughts on the return of Jon Stewart to The Daily Show, a check-in on a busy month in streaming, and a payoff to our Emmy bet that we made amongst ourselves and then forgot to set up on the podcast last month. So we'll explain what that is in a little while. But first, Bill, I want to start off with you this month. What was the best thing you saw on TV?
You know what, Alex? This was a great month for TV. So I'm going to give you two quick runner-ups. I'm just going to give you the names. I'm not even going to go into it. Marvel's Echo. Loved it. True Detective. Night Country. Go listen to Socially Distanced. Loved it. But the show I'm going to talk about is a show, I don't know, you've never talked about this one ever on this podcast, and that's Only Murders in the Building. I have finally watched the first season. My God, one of my favorite seasons of TV, easily makes the top 10 of all time. It is, if you don't know, it is a Hulu series starring Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez, whose name I almost forgot, and a who's who of cameos and special guests. It's sending up the true crime podcast culture that is prevalent throughout the United States, while also being an excellent murder mystery set in an apartment complex in New York City. It is all parts hilarious and exciting and emotional and sincere and thrilling and a real head scratcher. It is a perfect season of television. It's about 8 episodes, I want to say. You'll breeze through it. It is just a fantastic winter watch when you're just like, ugh, it is. If you're in the Northeast, it's either cold and snowy or warm and just raining and gross, and your sinuses are killing you like it is right now for me. I have a migraine the size of Montana doing this podcast. But I'm so happy to be here. Not a point. It is a perfect show to watch through this time of year. It's absolutely great. I can't wait to start season 2, although I have like 30 pieces of homework for other podcasts to do. But I am so excited to get into season 2. This is a great season of television. Alex, I know you told me, Al told me, everyone told me. And in true fashion, it only took me 3 years and I finally got there. So very happy to do this. Go watch it. It's on Hulu. Season 4 will be, I believe they have season 4 chalked up for this year.
I think late. Well, it usually comes out end of summer each year.
Fall, so yeah.
Yeah, so we'll probably see it around that time. I'm not sure if they've actually filmed it yet, but they did leave off in quite a cliffhanger, as they like to do, so that's very fun. How did you feel about the cliffhanger that this season 1 leaves off on?
Perfect. It's so great. It's so great. I love that, Alex, I did talk to you in real time about this, where I thought I had an idea about who the killer was, and you're like, And I was right that they weren't great, but not the killer. And the reveal to that of who the killer is in season 1 leads to an amazing performance from such an underrated actress who we're going to leave out, or actor maybe. Who's to say?
And I think you tipped it a little bit.
I fucking did, whatever. But also the way they leave it on season 2, going to season 2 is wonderful. It's just like, you're just like, oh, it's a real jaw dropper, like, and not something forced for the sake of being a jaw dropper. You're just like, wow, they really went to this place, and it's pretty great. And Martin Short gets better as the season goes along with his little throwaway. He has these throwaway lines. They're so brilliant. And if you're not paying attention, it'll hit you upside the head. You're like, I just can't believe he said that. It's absolutely awesome. So yeah, Only Murders in the Building, season 1. Can't recommend it enough.
It's great. Now, I do have to ask you one last question about this before we move on. It is a show technically about a true crime podcasting podcast, right? A true crime podcasting trio, I should say.
Yes.
And, you know, you've been in the podcast game for quite a while now. How did you feel about the presentation of how podcasting works on this show?
And way more money than we did. Yeah, I mean, it is the impetus of anyone can make a podcast, and let's see how you really commit to it. Yeah, it felt pretty on brand, because everyone's like, the launch of it, we've got 3 people listening to it and all this other stuff. I'm like, ah, yeah, this all sounds really familiar. And I've either from myself or others that have started podcasts on this site or have pitched podcasts to me over the years, it felt very accurate, and I felt seen a few times, for sure.
Except for when it comes
in
to
the
editing.
Selena Gomez character, mostly. But
when it comes to editing, they're like editing in the Only Murders in the Building universe is like going to the bathroom on 24. It's like you just have to imagine it's happening when no one is looking, because. Let me tell you, having a produced podcast in the way that they have it, where it's like the introduction and the monologues and all this stuff, and like editing together all of these like what seems to be hundreds of small audio clips, that would take days, and they just like turn it over in like 20 minutes.
Literally
before they put
having
it up at midnight.
Steve Martin monologue his opening in a non like soundproof, just open air New York apartment to an old-timey microphone that's connected to literally nothing. Yeah, I mean, that stuff, I'm just like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's weird that you pick 24. I mean, I know Keith or Sullivan really gets your blood pressure up. So, I mean, I was just thinking, you're like, when he goes to the bathroom, and Alex is just like, God, I just wish he would just never come out.
Yeah, that was my experience watching the show 24, which is a show that I totally watched all the time. Anyway, Josh, what is the best thing that you watch on TV?
You got that weird 24 tattoo on your bicep there. It was college was a wild time for you.
Yeah, it's the 24 signifies 24 hours of editing that I do for every podcast
that you're on with me. Yeah, I know.
Yes.
Yeah, Alex, you never sleep. You just edit podcast all night.
It's true. Yeah.
So my pick is not Only Murders in the Building, although I am very much wanting to watch that. Alex, I know you recommended that show,
Josh,
to both of us before.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a show that you would like.
You would love it. You and your wife. That's a couple's watch. Well, it's not only just a couple's watch, but it's a good couple's watch.
Sexiest Game of Scrabble, season 1 of Only Murders in the Building has.
I agree. I agree. Yeah.
Well,
that seat is wild.
Without knowing what that means, like, I will say Only Murders in the Building also had a bit of a popular winter because of it had a few episodes, or I think the whole first season, on ABC. So is that because of strikes and not having enough content? Is that because
100%.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Okay.
100%. That is one mystery that's not hard to solve.
Guys, I wanted to make it, at least a little bit mysterious.
No, we solved that one real quick for
you. Okay, Sherlock's. Okay, so on my...
That'll be on PBS soon enough, because there's no content for PBS.
So I guess there's a little bit of a detective vibe in mind, because I'm going to go with the Netflix live-action adaptation of Yu Yu Hakusho, which is about a spirit detective. So it's still a detective. We're still in the same vein. Mm. If you are not familiar with it, it is based on a very popular anime and manga where you have a teenager, Yasuki, who is killed, and he doesn't really have a place for him in the afterlife. He's a delinquent, and he's not really able to go to heaven, but he's also saved a child with his like last acts of life, and so he can't go to hell. And so they say, okay, we're going to keep you alive, or we're going to bring you back, and you are going to be this detective that solves all of these mysteries involving the different demonic entities in the world. And if it sounds weird, it kind of is.
Sounds like Constantine.
Kind of. Yeah, there's some similarities there. But it is really good. It's not quite as good as one of the other recent live-action adaptations Netflix did, which is One Piece. And I know we've talked a lot about how much we love that. So it isn't, again, quite up to that part, but it's still very good. And I'd say the action is arguably better. There is like some really tremendous fight scenes in it. Especially in the first episode, there's like a brutality to it that really is on par with some of the kind of the best martial arts films that you might see in a theater these days. Like very inventive, very creative, some Jackie Chan quality to it, just the way they use the scenery around them, which I always really appreciate. And it's also got this really good horror vibe. Like there's a that the demonic characters really are terrifying, especially in that first episode. So if you're interested in watching more after, you know, having watched the One Piece live action adaptation, I'd say give it a try. It's only 5 episodes. It's pretty short and it's a good time. So, and I will also say surprisingly heartfelt for a movie about a show, where you have a character with a spirit gun who, you know, shoots people with spirit energy. There's more heart to it than you'd expect.
Like how you buried the lead for me to watch the show. I'm like, all right.
It's a heartwarming teen comedy detective action horror show. Did I get that right?
Drama. Don't forget the drama.
Of course.
so it's Riverdale.
I mean, more or less.
And what is it called again, Josh?
It's a Yu Yu Hakusho.
Okay.
You're gonna have to send that to him.
Oh, I'll send it to you. Don't worry. I think you'd enjoy it.
I can't say I'm going to check that out right away, but I'm going to put it on the back burner because that sounds like a very interesting mix of different things that I would be interested in. So can't wait. I did see an ad on Netflix for a show called Marry My Dead Body, which was about like a queer like couple where like one person is dead and gets married to a detective who has to then solve the crime of their murder or something. I don't know. The description was very confusing to me, but it did make me think of this. But that's a Taiwanese show, not a Japanese show. So maybe
Alex,
a double feature.
Alex, what was the best thing you watched on TV this month? Because I know you have a lot to watch.
I did have a lot to watch, including 70 plus episodes of Batman the Animated Series, which I watched.
Day.
It was a week, not a day. Let's be fair. I did watch that for the other podcast that I was on this last month, Batman by the Numbers, where me and Dan Cohen and in absentia, Justin Mancini, who was unfortunately sick and couldn't be with us on mic, we ranked the top 15 Batman villains from Batman the Animated Series. Definitely check that out. That episode is really fun to record. I think a lot of people who have a lot of nostalgia for that show would get a kick out of listening to it, even if you haven't seen it in a really long time. Like me, I basically hadn't watched it in 25 years, and then same. I watched it all in a week. So, you know, that's how that goes. But no, it's not that. I do want to give a special shout out to True Detective Night Country, which I'm also watching, and yeah, I also think is excellent. But I will say, I feel like I'm probably going to be talking about it next month when it wraps up, so I'm going to kind of leave it there for now. Definitely check it out. It's worth watching. But mine is going to be Fargo Season 5. It wrapped up a couple weeks ago on Hulu and FX. This season was incredible. If you haven't been watching it, if you like watched the first few seasons of Fargo and fell off like me, definitely check it out. If you never watched any of them and you're like, well, can I watch season 5? Yes, because it's an anthology show. There's no connective tissue. It's just a new story, new characters. Juno Temple is out of this world on this show. She plays this like incredible, scrappy sort of like underdog woman who just is like refuses to be victimized and manipulated and abused. She triumphs over all of it, and just like in a way that is just incredible to see. Like, you cannot keep her in a cage as much as these people try. I've been a fan of Juno Temple's for a long time. I remember being excited when she got cast in The Dark Knight Rises all those years ago. But I've never seen her do anything like this. It's just absolutely incredible. And if you only know her as like Keeley from True Detective, imagine Keeley on True Detective. No, if you only know her as Keeley from Ted Lasso, and where she's this like bubbly, light kind of like, watch this show. It's going to blow your mind. She's just so out of this world. The ensemble is really good around her. Jennifer Jason Leigh plays this sort of arch billionaire who's in charge of debt collection agency. And she is just kind of like everything that you love and hate about rich people in modern day America, all wrapped up into one. You got Dave Foley. It has an eye patch in it. It's like, I mean, John Hamm has a nipple ring and is also a nightmare person. Truly terrifying and disturbing. You got Steve from Stranger Things as a fail son in this. I mean, Lamar Morris is there. So many great actors are filling this up. And it's just, it's having watched the entire thing, it just really comes together in a really, really strong way. And I just don't want to talk more about it because I feel like not enough people have seen this. I know that it did kind of take a little bit of it. It got a little bit of a popularity bump around the holidays when people were looking for things to watch. But I still, in my own personal life, feel like everybody's like, yeah, right, whatever. I'm still not watching it. And I really want you to. So everybody listen to this. I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it kind of like it, like half of like 2/3 of the season aired at the end of 2023, and then like the last third of the season airs in 2024. And so I think it gets kind of like screwed with like best of lists and things like that. But if this had aired a little bit earlier in the year, I think it would be topping a lot of best of lists. And it's just incredible. It's so, it's funny, it's smart, it has things to say about the world, but it's just a really gripping story with an incredible lead performance.
Yeah, we have weekly reviews of Fargo by Randy Elaine of Every Pod You Cast. You could check those out. They're super in-depth, not crazy spoilers in them. So if you want to like kind of like get it, like dip your toe and figure out what it is, go check our site, check the first review out. And everyone I know whose opinions I trust, including Alex, have just sung the praises to the moon. So yeah, if you haven't watched it and you're needing something, definitely check it out.
There was one character on the show that a lot of people really liked and I just couldn't stand. And I was like, the only thing I don't like about this show is this one character. And honestly, it took to the very last episode of the show. But in the very last episode of the show, they completely won me over and I became like an essential part of the why the show is great in the first place.
I heard about that, yeah.
Just like I like no notes, honestly, which is saying something considering the type of show that it is and considering how many notes the last couple of seasons of Fargo have elicited from us. So definitely check that out. Now we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, our Emmy bet payoff that we didn't tell you was going to happen.
Hi, this is Allison Lips from PopRight Goes to Washington. You may know me as the digital trends editor at PopRight and as a frequent guest on the Anniversary Brothers podcast. Every third Thursday of the month, join me and a guest as we break down various political movies from a pop culture perspective. You can find Pop Break Goes to Washington on the Pop Break Today feed wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Bill Bodkin, editor-in-chief of thepopbreak.com.
If you want to check out a really awesome new podcast, we have been invited to AEW Media Calls with AEW owner Tony Khan. And you can now find the audio for all of those podcasts now on the Pop Break Today feed. So every time he's talking about something AEW or something Ring of Honor, you're going to hear it from So Yeah, You Can Check Myself or Kimmy Sokol. We'll be every quarter over on the Pop Break Today feed.
All right, welcome back. Now it's time to shift gears and talk about the Emmys. Well, not really. It turns out not many people cared about the Emmys last month, as the telecast had a record low viewing audience of just 4.3 million viewers. However, Josh, Bill, and I were very invested in the outcome because we created a little wager between the three of us. We all did our best to predict the winners of every category that aired on the telecast. If Bill had won, he would have made us watch and discuss my most fearsome nemesis, the Great British Baking Show. If Josh had won, he would have made us watch an episode of an anime, which, you know, would have been interesting to see what he would have picked, but we never got that far. Thanks. Because if I won, we were going to talk about an essential episode of the wonderful television series of Reservation Dogs. Now, I am happy to report that despite it being neck and neck for a little while between me and Bill, I ultimately was the victor, guessing 20 out of 25 categories correct. Bill came in second with 18 correct predictions, and Josh third with 14 correct predictions. Tough look, Josh. Very sorry about that.
More than half.
Before we talk about which episode of Reservation Dogs I picked, do you guys have any thoughts on the Emmys, very briefly? Josh, let's start with you, since you were had the most surprising night of all of us.
The only thing I've literally heard about the Emmys was that bad joke about Taylor Swift, and that's it. Everything else just did not go anywhere. So I think the 4.1 million who watched it, like, they weren't really paying attention.
I actually watched the Emmys like a couple of days later because it was streaming on Hulu.
Because you
like
want to do a victory lap?
Yeah, exactly. No, I watched it because I heard that actually, like, the whole, it was the 75th annual, like, yeah, Emmy Awards, and they did a ton of, like, cast reunions on stage. Yeah. My favorite was definitely the Ally McBeal one, because, as you know, I love Ally McBeal. It's, like, special place in my heart. Yeah. They recreated the bathroom set, and they had them all come out of the stall and do their little dance, and I was just like, this is wonderful. And also, if people who were born after this must be so confused, because what the fuck is happening?
They weren't watching the Emmys, let's be honest.
Well, that is also true. Yeah, very much so. So I don't know. That was fun. There was a number of cast reunions that were really fun. A lot of the sets were recreated on stage, which was pretty cool. And that got me to watch it, and I'm glad that I did. But no one else did, and that's okay. TV is dying on broadcast, and that's just the way it is. I did think that NeNe Nash's big speech was awesome. Her acceptance speech, where she basically thanked herself for winning her award because she believed in herself and no one else did. And I thought that was awesome. Bill, do you have any thoughts about the Emmys?
What did NeNe Nash win for? Was it Dahmer?
It was for Dahmer.
Yeah, I heard she was amazing in that. This one was, I feel like the Emmys were just like, listen, we had the strike. This calendar was insane. Like, all right, we're just throwing it out there. We'll just get it done with. Like, we talked about offline. Like, there's two seasons of The Bear that has happened within this calendar. Like, it was all sorts of messed up. I feel like they were, let's just get through it. Let's give Succession all the wins and let's get through all the things we have to. I guess the big surprise, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alex, was that Ted Lasso didn't get anything.
In some circles that would have been seen as a surprise, but The Bear was such a juggernaut that I think much had a sense that that was going to own the night, and it did. Because I think what we've learned from the television watching Academy voters is that they watch about 4 or 5 shows a year, and they mostly like them, and so they're happy to award them all the awards. And tough break for the other 400 TV shows that air a given year.
Don't worry, we watch the ones on Amazon Prime that no one else does. We're good.
We sure did.
We're the good,
unfortunately. Yeah. But okay, so that's our very brief Emmy conversation that nobody cares about. Now we can talk about the episode of Reservation Dogs that I chose to make my co-host, and hopefully you at home watch. I wanted to find an episode that captured so much that is quintessential about the Res Dogs experience, while still being accessible to a first-time viewer who might not know all of the characters and their histories, because this is a show that really does, in a lot of ways, build on the presentation of the history and the community and all of that stuff. So it was a little bit hard to decide on that at first. You would have thought maybe the pilot would be a good place to start, because that's how everybody started. But I personally feel like it is only clear in retrospect that the ways in which the show's earliest episodes are brilliantly setting out these characters in the worlds that they inhabit. Listening to an episode last year of the podcast, Extra Hot Great, which is a great TV podcast that I recommend people check out after they listen to ours, of course. They inducted season 2, episode 7, aka Stay Gold Cheesy Boy, into their canon of great television episodes. While listening to that discussion, I realized that this is the episode. It's the best episode that can serve as an introductory to these characters and this world, at least in my opinion. So I'm going to talk briefly for people who maybe didn't watch the episode, and I understand if you didn't, but want to still participate in this conversation, a little bit more about this episode, and then we're going to throw it to Bill and Josh. So we start out the episode focusing on Cheese. He's the youngest and most emotionally mature member of the Res Dogs crew, as he inadvertently is arrested while visiting his quote-unquote uncle at the absolute worst time, and quickly finds himself living in a group home for wayward teens led by podcasting legend Marc Maron, playing an easily exacerbated man, trying to put good out into the world after climbing his way out of a troubled past, but sadly lacking all of the skills that would require that would allow him to actually pull that off. Over the course of the episode, we check in with other Res Dogs once or twice. We get to meet with Alora, who's interrupted from trying to put her personal touch on her childhood home, which she recently inherited after the death of her grandmother in the previous episode. We meet up with the rest of the gang to try to help them con their way into saving Cheese before being rebuffed by Cheese himself, who doesn't want to actually actually break the law, because he still hasn't yet, even if it means escaping from his current circumstances, which he is quoted as saying that he absolutely hates. Most of the episode, however, is devoted to Cheese's experience inside the group home. We watch as he adjusts to surroundings that keep him from the people and places he loves, disregards his personal identity, and initially devalues the traits he holds that make him such a wonderful character that we love to spend time with. And then we see his impact on those around him in small and big ways, as he helps foster a community and connection through an earnest emotional vulnerability and empathy until he is finally removed from the group home and placed to live with his adopted grandmother, a woman who Cheese met at a community health center last season and who was, at the time, in as much need of a grandson like Cheese as he was in a grandmother like her. I love this episode because, to me, it is a perfect blend of heart, humor, and community that this show does best. And it's one of the best shows on TV now or in the last 5 years. And I'm so happy that I got to share it with you guys. But with that all being said, Josh, I'm going to start with you. What did you think of the episode?
I liked it. Yeah, I definitely wanted to learn more about these characters from watching this. Again, having not watched any of this before, it did make me curious about some of these relationships and some of that backstory that you mentioned, Alex, was, you know, coming out and obvious. But what stood out for me was just that blend of humor and heart. That one scene with Cheese and two of the other teenagers there at the group home was just, it was an incredible scene. Like that scene blew me away. Just having him talk about the way that trauma and loss impacted him and it caused him to approach the world differently, and how him sharing this with these other two forced them to recognize that they are part of this larger community and that they need to support one another. Like that was, again, on one note, like there was a lot of funny lines in there, but it was also just incredibly like heartfelt. So I was impressed. I'm definitely going to watch more of this. So Alex, I'd say, you know, mission accomplished.
Yes, I'm so happy to hear that. Bill, what did you think?
I'd like to first talk point about this bet that I was trying to make Alex watch a show that he vehemently does not want to watch. Like this is Josh and I have talked about this. This is the happiest, nicest, kindest show on the face of the planet. And Alex is just a miserly old man when it comes to it. He just will not watch it. And then he's like, well, you guys got to watch Reservation Dogs. I'm like, oh shit, like a critically acclaimed series that all the people whose opinions I trust are like, this is a great show. What a hardship for me. You know, so it was like, whatever. It just, the fact I got 20 right proves that, you know, dad still gets something left in the tank when it comes to picking stuff. But regardless, let's get into the episode itself. Alex, this is a perfect episode to pick for anyone to drop in, because it was sort of, as you've talked about in other stuff we've covered, like a hangout episode, because it's just like we've set the vibe of the show. There's not huge stakes in terms of plot. We're not in the middle of like, oh, this character you've never met is in trouble, you know, is dead and they're all mourning, or like, because I know that's a big thing, there's a big funeral arc for one of the characters, like they have to go through this, and like it presents us like what this region is like, what these all these characters' lives are like, what their relationship is together. Let's focus on this one character. I always have a special place for my heart and Mark Maron. He gave me one of my biggest stories of all time, who was like the kickoff to a big freelance career for me. Got me on the cover of a newspaper covering it. So I will always love Mark Maron, and I think he's perfect. He was amazing.
He is to you like what that Native American man that
he is,
his character met in the woods.
He is my journalistic, you know, yeah. Lakota medicine person. And yes, and it was great. But he's perfect. I mean, if you didn't see him in Glow, he was amazing in that. He was amazing in this. But I love Lane Factor, who plays Cheese. He is just like this brilliant young actor who, like, you know, when they talk about like characters that are more mature for their wise beyond their years, those characters usually aren't fun to be around. They're usually very annoying caricatures on CBS sitcoms. Essentially, I'm talking about their young Sheldon, essentially. And just because I was watching a football game today and there was a million commercials for the series finale, and I'm like, just get rid of it. Not the point, but it's, he's so wonderful and such a real character. Like, you can see a kid like this, like, out in the world. Like, you could go down the street and there's this kid. You know, his name is Cheese. He's, like, in your kid's sixth grade class or, you know, junior high. And, you know, he's just who he is. And you're just like, okay, that's a real person right there. And to me, if this is what this show is, like, yes, I definitely want to continue with it. Of course, I have 7,000 pieces of homework to do for other shows, but this is a show that's like, it's a digestible half an hour show with a good heart. It's the easiest type of show to get into. And it was such a greatly performed episode. And if you just came off of Echo, like I did, you're seeing cast members from Echo in this show, like Devery Jacobs. And you're like, oh, okay, I know, I got a little taste of this person, of what they can do. Now I want to see what they could do more of. And obviously, this is a show you can see that in.
Yeah. And I honestly, like, no disrespect to Echo, which is a show that, like,
used well at all.
I think that, if you compare, she has two and a half scenes, basically, yes, in this show.
I agree with what you're going to say.
All of them put together, maybe 2 minutes of screen time. And I feel like you get a better sense of who this character is, yeah, and what she cares about and what her relationships are and all of that stuff so much better in those 2 minutes than the like schizophrenic kind of broken into pieces arc that her character in Echo gets in
100%. 100%. Like, not even a question.
And it like, and that goes to show that it's not just like, oh, like her storyline got cut down or whatever. Like, if you have a marriage between a great actor who really understands her character and great writing that really understands the character, you can convey so much in the smallest moments in the corner of a scene. And that's something that this show gets right every single time. And it's one of the reasons why I love it so much.
Yeah, it's great. It really is.
Another Echo alum is, of course, Zane McLaren, who has a pretty fun appearance towards the end of this episode.
That
was
great.
Yeah. Talk about more about what you liked about that, Bill.
Oh, because it's this whole thing is like Zane McLaren plays a cop who's going to take Cheese away to, you know, his new home. But we saw an earlier scene where another member of the home was taken away and he just talks shit to the cops, and they had this conversation that Josh was referencing earlier where it's just like, you gotta talk shit to a cop, and he's like, oh, I just want to get on their good side. So he's like, can I talk shit to you on the way out? And he's like, just don't make it personal. And of course he went way overboard because he's a kid and I don't want to give away the joke, but of course, you know, Zane McLaren in his own way, he's such a great actor. He's like from Dr. Sleep to Westworld, one of the great episodes of that show that has nothing to do with the main part of that show. And he just is such a, like a loving, like father, uncle figure to him. And it's just like a really sweet foul mouthed moment that of course I would love. Cause if I love anything, it's horrible language with a heart of gold. So,
but the thing that I love most about that is like when Cheese tries to do the thing, he not only goes too far, but also like he just does it completely wrong because it's like it's so not him to do that. So he just says it in such like a blunt way that's like not even fun, you know, which for us to watch it is actually really fun. So such a sweet show.
It's really good. And then I mean, Alex, just for us who obviously this is our first time in it, is this really like how the tone of the show is throughout?
Yes. Yeah. This is what the show is. It is not because and that's why I really love this episode, because what it captures is the show is really heartfelt and it is funny, and it's not just funny in a sort of saccharine sweet kind of way. There is some kind of like edgier humor to it. There's some, it feels like these are real kids talking to each other, you know? It doesn't feel like the TV safe, like Ted Lasso approved, like we're jocks, but like we are in a Wes Anderson movie kind of vibe that Ted Lasso has, you know? Like it's like these feel like real kids who would say this kind of stuff, and like there's a little bit of like edge to it in different moments, but it's also just so heartfelt and so sweet and so emotionally honest. And part of that emotional honesty is that sort of like optimism about being part of a community and what that can do for a group of people who are in need. And part of it is being honest about like the darkness of the emotions that these people are experiencing. It doesn't shy away from the fact that they've been through trauma and they've been through serious loss, and they're kind of living on the edge of a certain kind of society, and they're also kind of enveloped in a really supportive community that over the course of the show, the kids learn to really respect and be grateful for, in a way that when we first meet them, maybe they're being more rebellious towards it because that's all they know and they want to be part of the bigger world. And they really come to understand like what a gift that community is for them by the end of the arc. But this is really what the show is. And like you talk about, like it's not connected to the whole big like death arc, but it is in the way that you see it, where, and that's how they talk about it in the show. Like the first episode, we see these kids, these like teenagers. They're clearly going through something, but we don't necessarily get what it is right away. And over the course of the first season, you come to learn that their best friend and cousin has killed himself. Basically, the teenager's depressed, he kills himself, and they're dealing with that, and they're trying to figure out how to move forward and figure out who they are in this world. Do they want to follow in those footsteps? Do they feel like they need to live for that person? Do they need to figure out how to live their own life, you know, and all of that stuff? But the ways in which it comes in, and that's why it's hard to talk about, I feel like, because when you talk about that, it's like, wow, that seems really heavy, really dark, really depressing. But the way that it comes in is in moments like what you saw, where it's like Cheese's grief and confusion, and it led to a beautiful moment of connectedness that would have never happened if Cheese wasn't there and hadn't experienced the things that he experienced. And that's like the best possible outcome, I think, in life for when hard things happen to people, especially young people, is that they learn how to live with it and they learn how to derive wisdom from it and how to be better, fuller people. And that's the way that this show handles that kind of stuff. And it's really beautiful, and it's really honest, and it's really funny, and it's really great. And it's just a show that I love so much. And I'm glad that you guys really liked this episode.
I'll say one final thing is, like, this show ended after three seasons, and I like the fact that the creator was like, I made the choice to end it after three seasons. So this doesn't feel like a Netflix show that you liked and it got, our streaming show that got, you liked and it got axed after two seasons with no resolutions. It feels like this does wrap up in
it
some
very
ways.
Very much does.
And I think makes for a more attractive, bingeable show when there is an end to it. And you just hear, oh, it's not on anymore. And you're like, oh, it's, you know, typical streaming. And you hear, no, they decided to do that. And I think that's reassuring to the quality.
Yeah, they told their story, and it really feels like a closed story by the end of it. And the characters all go through different experiences and journeys, and it all feels like specific to those characters and yet part of the whole. And along the way, you learn so much about that community and the history of that community, and you get flashback episodes, and you get these great kind of surrealist moments. Something that this episode doesn't have that a lot of episodes do is a level of magical realism, like spirits, ancestors come and talk to these kids and help them figure stuff out. And that seems like maybe it'll be weird or hokey, but it just is so well integrated into the show and into the culture that you're seeing that it just feels effortless. And I guess the last thing I want to say is that I really love that this episode ends with Cheese getting to live with his quote-unquote grandma. And that's something that you guys might not have gotten as much out of, since there's not a ton of context for her in this episode. But basically, like I said in the intro to this segment, she's this woman that basically, like, Cheese is someone whose parents are not part of his life, and he's just kind of like on his own, and he's taken care of by this community because he's part of the community, and the community is his family, but his immediate family is not part of his life. And he's the youngest of this group of kids. Most of the other ones are like 16, 17 when the show starts out. He's a little bit younger than that. And so he's a little bit of an outsider even to them in that way. And there's a little bit of loneliness to him, even though there's this purity and their innocence. And he meets this woman who, in the kind of health center in the community. And basically it starts out where she is having like surgery done on her eyes, so she can't see, she can only hear. And he kind of like runs into her, and she mistakes him for her grandson. And he's just like lonely and like wants to connect and wants to be with this person. And so he like starts talking to her and like indulges her into thinking that he's her grandson. And then at a certain point, you realize that like, she knows that it's not her grandson, but that they have this connection and that it's good for both of them to have this in their lives. And so then they continue that relationship. And I love that that's what rescues him, because it's an act of kindness and an act of community and an act of connection that he did in a very selfless way, just trying to be there for someone who he viewed as in need while also kind of being in need himself. And that's the thing that ultimately saves him from this situation as well, because it's this ultimate kind of like validation of who Cheese is as a person, you know. And I just think that's beautiful.
That's really nice, actually. Sorry, that's really nice.
Josh, any last thoughts before we move on?
I think just the last thing I'll add is, from what I saw in this episode, it does a really wonderful job of balancing this universal presentation of, okay, this is what it means to be an adolescent. You know, this is what it means to be a member community that I think all of us can relate to, while also showing a very specific culture, and showing respect and appreciation for that. So that balance of relatability, but also, giving, space and time for a culture that's not always given enough space and time on TV, I think is a wonderful combination. And again, it makes me want to watch more.
I'm glad. I'm going to hold you to that. I want you to have watched more episodes by this time next month. Not Bill. He's off the hook. But Josh, you got to do it.
Yes, sir.
A lot. Okay. I got to watch.
You got three X-Men movies to watch coming up.
I got three X-Men movies. I got Legend. I got multiple Avatar episodes for a cartoon and live action. And then I have something else I have to watch. So I got a lot. I got three episodes of Peaky Blinders. I got to watch them.
Of course.
Oh, goddamn son of a bitch.
Stay tuned to Pop Break TV, Pop Break Today, and of course, Socially Distanced for all of the shows that Bill just talked about. In the meantime, we're going to move on to our news break segment, where we discuss one of the biggest stories in the world of TV this month. Now, for this month's segment, we are going to be reacting to the news that Jon Stewart has agreed to return to the host chair of Comedy Central's The Daily Show, which he handed over to Trevor Noah in the summer of 2015. Since then, The Daily Show's place in the media landscape faded a bit, even while successfully launching Trevor Noah's U.S. career. That is in part due to the changing nature of political satire, the changing nature of cable TV, and the way in which former Daily Show supporting contributors like John Oliver and Samantha Bee successfully launched their own shows at various points, seeming to eclipse Noah's The Daily Show. In late 2022, Noah unexpectedly quit the show to focus more on his stand-up and building a film career for himself. Late in 2022 also marked the last season of Jon Stewart's show, The Problem with Jon Stewart, which aired on Apple TV+. That show ended, also unexpectedly, because Jon Stewart quit after demands from Apple to not cover topics such as China out of fear of what critical coverage of the country could mean for their manufacturing plants in the country, which did not go over well with Jon Stewart, as you could imagine. So with Jon in need of a job, ostensibly, and with Paramount Global, the parent company for Comedy Central, still looking for a host even after spending over a year filling the chair with guest hosts, many might say that this reunion was inevitable, even if Jon will only be hosting the talk show on Monday nights with the series supporting players filling in on the other three nights that it airs. But Bill, what do you think about Jon Stewart returning to his roots following the collapse of his Apple show?
I like the move and I don't like the move. It's a half pregnant type thing for me. It's like, why not just commit even on a short term election span to have Jon Stewart on the show every night? That's what I'm not. Because I mean, we're in an election cycle. Listen, if you forgot that, it's okay. The world has been insane for the last 8 years, so a lot's happened. But I think there's going to be so much happening with this election that it's and what's going to happen here and what could potentially happen within the country. We also have so much going on internationally that's going to impact this election that I feel like Jon Stewart needs to be on 4 to 5 nights a week. Like, however, I can't remember if the Daily Show aired Monday through Friday. I don't remember if it aired Friday.
Yeah, it doesn't air. It never aired on Friday. So it was just Monday remember. Through Thursday. So, and so that's why we got 1 day with Stewart. We got 3 days with the supporting players.
I just feel that, especially given how big an election is, especially with the people in it and the stakes at hand, he should be there 4 nights a week. He was a major voice in so many elections going in the past. And I just feel like it's kind of a weird thing. It's like, hey, he's back. It just doesn't feel right. Like, it's
Josh,
cool,
what do you think? But not. Do you think that you're feeling half pregnant also, like Bill?
Oh, gosh, I hope not. I
always half pregnant with emotion at all times, guys. Oh.
It's my favorite Meatloaf song. Anyway, Josh.
Sorry.
You just killed Bill. Congratulations.
It happens once a show. It's fine. I wasn't expecting Meatloaf of all people, but sure.
The problem with having Jon Stewart back is that no one watched The Problem with Jon Stewart. Yeah. It really doesn't matter. Like, right before this news came out, Alex, you had shared that they had decided that they were going to have a host at all, that they were just going to have total reliance on their cast of you know,
quote unquote correspondence.
Yes, correspondence. And that was already kind of cringy and like, okay, you have one, either no courage, or two, you don't want to pay someone enough to be the host. And now this is, okay, wow, you really don't have courage, because not only do you want to not, I don't know, look for some new talent or try to promote someone that you've been developing, you're just going to say, well, that guy we used to have, he's open. Maybe we can just pencil him in, but not really. So they managed to do both the most cowardly thing of not hiring someone full time and the second most cowardly thing of going back to what's worked previously. Oh, let's just get the guy that we previously had. It's altogether really embarrassing. And it's something that is especially unfortunate because in an election year, the Daily Show is at its most important. And what this has done is it's taken the teeth out of it. Like, I don't know. I don't see people coming to the episodes without Jon Stewart. I think they're going to see Jon Stewart episodes have, you know, pretty good viewership, and I think the rest of the week is going to be pretty down, and they're going to probably then have to question at some point, oh gosh, do we pay Jon Stewart more money and just have him do the whole thing, in which case what are we doing here? Like, it just seems like totally ham-fisted and, you know, planned with no foresight.
Like, yeah, it's planned with the foresight of someone who is selling the company in a year.
Like a bat out of hell, Josh really got the point that I wanted to make, but said it much more eloquently. And yes, that was a Meatloaf reference, if you were wondering.
Yes. Well, it's going to be Paradise by Jon Stewart's Dashboard Lights as he's driving away from the studio.
Damn it. He got it.
Because
it's so much better.
Because he only has to be there once a week. And I think that was, you know, how do you get Jon Stewart to show up to the Daily Show, to walk back the sands of time and be like, okay, you're going to, you left a triumph, a hero, like a era defining figure in political satire. You went on to make some strange appearances on the Colbert late night show and then an Apple show that, Josh, you say nobody watched, and you are in some ways correct, but in other ways not correct, because he did have several videos from those episodes go viral online. Kind of challenging lawmakers, his challenging on issues of trans rights, on issues of gun safety, things related to the treatment of first responders from 9/11. There, a number of those stories actually broke out in a big way. And I feel like the reason why letting him come back in a part-time capacity is probably palatable to Comedy Central and Paramount Global more significantly, because ultimately nobody really runs Comedy Central anymore, is because they really only want someone who can go viral like once or twice a week. And if he's only on once a week, you're just saying like, all right, instead of giving you four bites at the apple, we're going to give you one and hope that you hit a grand slam each time, to mix my metaphors.
Pun intended. And,
you got it. But yeah, so I think that's why they feel like it's okay, because they're not really making the show for linear TV ratings. They're making it for like YouTube ad revenue, honestly, because at this point cable, like basic cable, is little more than a money laundering scheme for these major corporations. People don't know this, but it really is true. They get these like subscription rates that are set years in advance that the cable providers have to pay to these companies for all of their shows, for all of their networks. And pretty much at this point, there's only like one or two networks from any of these companies that any of the cable providers want, but they still have to eat all of the other ones that come with, and everyone comes with their own fees. And then they get like minimal ad support, and then that's it. And the subs are declining. The numbers eventually are going to start coming down. And so the move that all of these companies together have made are, we're not going to put any money into these channels anymore. We're going to shift all of the creative executives, all of the creative like talent into our streaming services, because that's where the growth is. And we're going to leave these networks to just collect money passively for as long as they can. And I really think that they were just like, we can't cancel The Daily Show because that would look bad, and it might risk us getting the fees that we want from Comedy Central. But if Jon Stewart comes back and he posts like two or three big videos a month for the next 12 months, it's going to make it through a year And by the end of that year, hopefully we will have sold our company, which is what is actively trying to happen right now. And then it's someone else's problem. And that sucks because The Daily Show as a brand certainly is not what it used to be, but it has the potential to be. It could be really important. You're saying like, Bill, you're saying like, for it's an election year. It's so important that The Daily Show is there. I don't know if it really is anymore, but it certainly could be.
No,
it could serve that role again if it had the opportunity to. And I think if you're looking for, like, they really did seem to try to find a replacement for Trevor Noah for a while. And it seemed like what they kept running into is the ad revenue is declining significantly on Comedy Central. I think it's down 30%+ year over year from last year alone. It's really bad. It's only going in one direction. There's no sense that it's going to go in the opposite. So why would you sign a major talent to a long-term deal at big money when this company is probably not even going to exist in a couple of years, let alone be able to support a paycheck like that? So I get that they couldn't do that. But like Josh alluded to, I really wish they would have just instead chosen to take a chance on a rising talent. Comedy is filled with these people. There's tons of people who are starting out trying to get noticed. It's in some ways easier than ever, in some ways harder than ever to get noticed in the comedy landscape. Find somebody. There's definitely good talent at that tier, at that price tier that you could bring in, and it would be big shoes to fill, but somebody would be capable of doing it, you know?
And if I could you could still bring Jon Stewart back on a vertical. Like every Monday is Jon Stewart, but your host is Josh Sarnacki. You know what I mean? It's just like, hey, here's the new host of The Daily Show, but every Tuesday, every Monday, he's going to have Jon Stewart in residency for that. So he's not the host, but he's going to be the draw. And this way, this person's going to get the rub from Jon Stewart saying like, hey, this person really held their own with Jon Stewart. I want to see this person on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that's, and you wouldn't even have to, it could be someone who's just, like you said, not a household name, and you don't have to pay them an exorbitant amount of money. You sign them to a short-term deal.
Yeah.
You think someone wouldn't take that? They definitely would take that.
I'm sure that probably somewhere plan is to let the correspondents host the other days, and maybe somebody breaks out and can take over at the end of it. That's probably like the lip service thing, but I don't really think that anybody believes that. I think they really are saying like, we literally need to make it to the next deadline, and then it'll be someone else's problem, and then we can take it from there. And I just think that's a bad way to run a grocery store, never mind cable company. I also think that, you know, ultimately, I feel like Jon Stewart has a lot to lose in this and not a lot to gain by coming back. There's one path where he comes in as like a conquering hero and he owns everybody and everybody loves what he does and everything like that. And that'll be great if that happens. And then he walks away again in 12 months and everybody's like, hooray, he did it, whatever. But that's the only way that this goes well for him. Any other outcome is him kind of really, you know, sullying his legacy. And I don't know why he's choosing to do that. But I will say one last note. So there is a wrinkle to this that we haven't talked about yet, which is the Hasan Minhaj factor. Because for a lot of people might not know this, but Hasan Minhaj, who started out on The Daily Show, he had his own Netflix show for a while. He was very successful until Netflix canceled it because they were like, we don't really like topical stuff, actually, because China. Crazy how all the tech companies are in that same situation. So they ultimately walked away from it. And Hasan went on to The Daily Show, did a number of guest hosting appearances. And it has been confirmed through reporting that they actually offered him this position back in May. And he accepted it back then. But they withheld the deal from the media, and they did not finalize it at the time. Although that is actually, Minhaj is threatening to sue on that point, whether it was finalized or not. Because they didn't want to let anybody know what was happening during the strikes. It was considered like poor form and maybe a violation of like union rules to announce a deal like that during the strikes. So they said, okay, we'll wait until the strikes are over. Once the strikes are over, we'll announce you as the new host of The Daily Show. Fantastic. Everybody's happy. Until in late summer, The New Yorker published a major expose on Hasan Minhaj saying he actually lies all the time in his stand-up about a lot of things that are really from very small things to pretty big things. And that kind of tanked his potential to be The Daily Show host as a result. And I think also what happened between May and like August, September, when all this is happening, is the Paramount Global started to see those ad numbers really drop, and they realized we probably can't afford to have Hasan Minhaj be the host, even if we wanted to, actually, as it turns out. So ultimately, they pulled the plug on that whole thing, and he's really upset, and I can understand why, even though maybe he deserves it. Depends on your opinion. We're not going to get into that right now, but I am curious, would you have rather seen, let's like, I guess we can't pretend like the lying controversy didn't happen, so we have to factor that in, but we don't have to get too far deep into that whole thing. But would you rather have seen Hasan Minhaj be the host of The Daily Show, Bill?
You know, before all that stuff came out, you would have said yes, but I even remember there was controversy. Wasn't there also controversy about him around his Netflix shows too? Like, there was some stuff going on that it didn't paint him in a good light, I want to say.
It was one of those things, though, where it's like, I don't know how much that was real or how much that was like, they ended on bad terms, and his camp publicized a bunch of stuff about them, and then their camp published a bunch of stuff about him.
I think that's been long enough for that, and had that just been swept under the, had that just time had, you know, the dust had settled on that, I think he would have made an excellent host of The Daily Show. But I also think it's, excuse me, the confluence of a lot. Like you said, money, he's going to cost a lot of money. He is very popular. And two, you found out he's kind of, he made up a lot of stuff. That's really going to, that would damage his credibility as, you know, someone who's going to be coming in and talking about the news. You want someone who's who has an air of credibility, even though it is a comedy, you know, you still need someone who has credibility there. And I think that tanked his the perception of credibility. I'm not saying he's not credible. I'm just saying the perception of the audiences would be like, I don't know if I trust this guy. And you don't want that for that show.
Josh, would you be able to trust a fake newscaster if you knew that he told an audience full of millions that his daughter was rushed to the hospital for contracting anthrax, even though that never happened?
Ooh, who's to say? But I obviously, you know, the controversy with him, like, I think it made sense that he was dropped. Like, I can understand that part of the story. What I can't understand is that Comedy Central and, you know, their mothership had this option to have so many auditions and had a lot of positive feedback from some of them, and then decided, you know what, none of you get the job. This is like if you have...
I hope they said it just like that, too.
No, like,
you know what? God, if you get it.
This is like if you have...
Remind me to never work for you, Josh. Jesus
this
Christ.
Is the New England Patriots saying, oh, wow, we can't have anyone good at quarterback. Let's get Tom Brady back, but only let him play for one quarter every game this coming season. That will solve all our problems, and then we can sell the team at the end of the season. That's what this is.
Yeah.
It's if terrible. Only they had sold the team, it would have worked out. But let's not talk about Bob Kraft. Instead, we're going to move right on to the streaming wars. This month, there was a lot to discuss. We saw streamers competing for the Emmys, Golden Globes, Oscar nominations, and live sports audiences, even as the original series output dipped pretty significantly over the last month. So, Josh, now that you have dismissed all of The Daily Show's cast for their services, who do you think had the best month in streaming?
I know in our chat before this, there was a lot of praise being thrown towards Netflix. And so, obviously, I can't give to Netflix. No. I have
so cutthroat today.
I don't know. There's something in my tea. I don't know what it is.
The fact Detroit might go to the Super Bowl and the Packers are sitting,
you know,
home.
I don't mind that. I can respect Detroit all for their long suffering fan base.
I'm allowed to get it once, right?
Liar.
Yes.
Such
yes.
a liar.
One streamer that I thought I never could respect, but this month has turned me around, is Peacock. Because Peacock has been the butt of the joke from the beginning. And it managed to pull off its best month ever. Netflix had an amazing month. That is without a doubt. And objectively speaking, it should probably be my winner. But let me just share some of the things that Peacock has done or has been revealed from Peacock. So it was revealed that last year they reached 31 million subscribers, which was up almost 50% from the previous year. They reached $1 billion in revenue for the first time. And that was all before the big news this January that they were the first streaming service to have exclusive rights to an NFL playoff game. And not only was it any NFL playoff game, it was an NFL playoff game featuring the defending Super Bowl champions and Taylor Swift. That's a pretty big deal.
Notice you didn't say who they were playing.
Because they didn't show up either. So yeah, the game itself
I don't understand the joke.
They were terrible. It essentially was a bad game.
the Dolphins wet the bed. It was terrible. But that still did really well for Peacock. We had around 23 to 25 million viewers on average for that game, which according to Peacock, which, you know, take this with a grain of salt, was a record for a live streamed event. That weekend, they gained almost 3 million
in the
subscribers.
United States.
That's a record not just for Peacock, but that's a record for live streaming yes. events in the U.S., period.
Yes. Yep. Yes. So, yeah, not
and
just
also,
Peacock.
And also, just to point out, 23 million people watched that. Only like 35, 36 million people subscribe to Peacock. So that means that like 80% of the subscribers were activated just yes. to watch that one football game, which is crazy.
Yes.
I streamed it.
Yeah. Yeah. And to make the situation even better for Peacock, not only did that have the success of getting eyes on the football game, but it also had people stick around for the big show that they were trying to promote, which they were promoting tirelessly on NBC during their other football games, which was Ted. The Ted show managed to have its biggest debut of any original show on Peacock. And it's actually gotten somewhat good reviews, surprisingly.
It has, Alex.
No,
it's gotten
it
some decent,
it's
decent
gotten
reviews.
Mixed reviews at best.
It was at a 70-something on Rotten Tomatoes, so that's a little bit more than mixed, I'd
yeah,
say.
But it was like I think it was like 54% on Metacritic, so.
Metacritic. Come on.
So in addition to that, the biggest thing that's coming this coming month from Peacock is that they're going to get Oppenheimer, which just, you know, was nominated for a ton of Oscars and is very likely to win several of them after doing very well at the Golden Globes. So the last thing I'll just say is that this isn't really impacting right now for Peacock, but they have been advertising a lot on NBC, the Olympics coverage, and it was previously announced that Peacock is going to have all of the Olympic events this summer. All of them are going to be available to watch on Peacock. So
yeah, the last one was just oof. They did not do a good job with that.
No. So they know we're about up from there. So Peacock won the month for me, even if Netflix probably had a better time.
I'm gonna add one thing to Josh's point. The Royal Rumble from WWE this Saturday was the most watched Royal Rumble ever. And that has been going on for over 30 years. So that was a huge event for them. So that's just another feather in the cap of the Peacock.
And given the overlapping audience, the potential overlapping audience, that does suggest that the NFL gamble paid off for them, right? It means that they probably retained at least some of those viewers to watch Ted and to watch Royal Rumble, two things that people who watch the NFL might be interested in. And I think that's a pretty good deal for them, right? Because that's the whole thing. You got people in the door, and a lot of people were pretty annoyed about it. But how many people are going to cancel right afterwards? Some, for sure. Definitely some. But some people will be like, nah, I forgot how to cancel. Other people will be like, well, let me see if there's something that'll keep me and my attention. And, you know, like you said, Bill, Royal Rumble, like you said, Josh, Ted, and also Oppenheimer, which is not just, you know, likely to win some Oscars. It is the odds-on favorite for Best Picture. It also made like $500 million at the box office. People like this movie. They've heard about it for a long time. So the fact that it's going to be on Peacock, kind of a big deal. And I'm going to say, yeah, Josh, I'm right there with you. Peacock is mine as well. For all of the reasons that you said, I had them all written down. I'm going to add that not only is Oppenheimer coming this week, I believe, to Peacock, but they also still have The Holdovers there, which is another big Oscar movie.
Yeah.
And overall, Comcast, which owns Peacock, they also own Universal Studios and Focus Features, which are two big Oscar contenders. If you combine their total nominations for Oscars, you get 18, which is tied for the second most nominations with Netflix. So that's a pretty big deal, because all of those things are coming to Peacock at least for a time or two until they move other places, and they'll be back eventually. So, you know, I think that it's great. I think that it's so hilarious that Barbenheimer happened because Christopher Nolan was so angry that Warner Brothers Films agreed to let movies air a debut on HBO Max and theaters simultaneously. He found that deeply offensive. He left the studio that he had spent 20 years of his life for. On his way out the door, he said that HBO Max was the worst streaming service of all time, and it was pathetic that they would do this. He then makes Oppenheimer for Universal, and Warner Brothers, out of spite, programs Barbie the same day to be like, fuck you, we're not going to let you have this opening weekend to yourself. It ends up creating a huge cultural phenomenon where Barbie ends up helping Oppenheimer make way more money than Oppenheimer ever would have because of the Barbenheimer thing. And now it all culminates in Oppenheimer being available on Peacock, which is, despite winning the month, most likely pretty fairly the worst streaming service.
And that's how I'll be watching Oppenheimer for the first time this weekend. So, yay.
So I just love it when things come full circle. Bill, did Peacock go 3 for 3? Did it win the triple crown?
It's actually a tie for me because I couldn't pick. Because I have,
you
I can't
give a tie.
I could do whatever I wanted from this shit for 15 years. No.
Not on my show.
All right. Well, then I'm not going to give it to Peacock because it does deserve the accolades, but I am going to go with Netflix. And I am going to talk about this because it's a huge deal because it's something I've been a fan of for a long time. But also, listen, a $5 billion deal to secure the live streaming rights for WWE is a huge, huge deal for Netflix. So for people who don't know, it was announced earlier this week that the TKO Group, which owns WWE and UFC, just went into a deal with Netflix to take Monday Night Raw off of NBC, off of USA Network, and take it to a live stream Monday starting in 2025. They also secured the international rights for Monday Night Raw, NXT, and every single premium live event WWE produces, which is, they're not calling pay-per-views anymore, they're calling premium live events outside of the United States. So that includes WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Royal Rumble, Survivor Series, those big four that have been around for as long as we've all been alive. So those are huge events, and they got those for a steal. They are paying essentially for Monday Night Raw, and almost the international stuff got like thrown in, and that's going to be huge money for Netflix. I also look at what they're paying a little under $10 million per episode, so per year. So about $9.6 million per episode for 3 hours of content that runs live 52 weeks a year. Just to give you an example of how much that is, an episode of Stranger Things season 4 costs $30 million to make. That's 1 hour of content. That is about three episodes of...
It was Stranger Things season 4, so it was probably about 2.5 hours of content, let's be fair.
For one episode, is what I'm saying. So I'm just saying,
yes,
like,
for one episode. We remember what that season was like.
You think that, but they were an hour plus episodes, but it's like three episodes of Monday Night Raw per one episode of Stranger Things. Obviously, Stranger Things is going to draw more, but they now have Set It and Forget It content for the next 10 years. They also have a 5-year opt-out that if Monday Night Raw doesn't work for them, they can leave, or they have an automatic 10-year renewal, which takes them to when I'm like 60, which is fucking frightening to even think about. And they also, of course, subscribers are up. They're looking to phase out their basic ad-free tier, so more people can pay for the ad-supported tier, which again, adding Monday Night Raw, which is starting to gain more traction with major advertisers, allows Netflix to go make more money off ads. And you now also have Dwayne Johnson on the TKO board, which allows Dwayne Johnson to now be on Netflix even more. And WWE will be getting Netflix produced documentaries off of that. And there's also a Vince McMahon documentary, which that's going to take a hell of a turn given all of that. He is no longer associated with WWE. So that is going to be very interesting to see as well. And also, listen, you still have releases that came out this year. They came out last year, still trickling over, like Blue Eye Samurai, the new Avatar sequel is coming out. Rebel Moon, despite what Amanda and I said on Socially Distance, did very well for them when it released towards the end of December into January. They've had a really strong month. I cannot deny that Peacock had a great month, but my vote has to go with Netflix due to this deal alone, because I'm very curious to see where this takes WWE and where this also takes live sports with Netflix going forward. And hopefully this is a trickle down to Warner Bros. Discovery, where they, like other companies out there that have wrestling, will be putting their stuff on streaming as something they don't have right now. So that is my choice. very on brand for me.
So I do disagree with you, but I will help bolster your case just a little bit.
No, I got to talk about it. So
they got, they did get 18 Oscar nominations. Pretty big deal. They don't have like a hard contender right now in the Best Picture race, but they are likely to get at least a couple of wins in there next month. We also have 22 Emmy wins this month, led by the complete like steamroller that is Beef, which also swept the miniseries categories in at the Golden Globes and the Critics' Choice Awards, and is likely to at the SAGs, which are broadcasting on Netflix in next week, in 2 weeks, very soon. Good stuff happening in Netflix. So happy for them, as always. The underdog kids make good. We love that. Speaking of underdog kid who makes good, it's now time to move on to our final segment, a new series spotlight, where we talk about a new series and give it a spotlight every month. This month, we're reviewing Griselda, Netflix's new series starring Modern Family's Sofia Vergara as real-life Colombian drug lord Griselda Blanco, who came to prominence in the 1980s Miami and was known as the godmother of cocaine. The series was produced by Vergara alongside Narcos co-creator Eric Newman, and it was also written by Narcos co-creator Doug Miro and directed by Andres Baez, who, you guessed it, directed 12 episodes of Narcos in addition to 4 episodes of Narcos Mexico. So lots of Narcos in the DNA of this show. It also stars Alberto Guerra as Dario, an enforcer of the cartel who becomes close to Griselda. Jose Zuniga, who played Ghost Rider's evil uncle in season 4 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that you could hear me ranting about in a recent episode of Bill vs. the MCU from this past fall. And also, speaking of the MCU, Maximiliano Hernandez as Pepo, who MCU fans might be surprised to learn is also the person who played Jasper Sitwell.
Where was he? He's not the episode Pepo. I saw.
Yeah, he's a big deal. I've seen 4 episodes of this show, wow. Way more than I expected to watch. Josh, how much of this have you seen?
First episode.
Okay, Bill?
Uno.
Okay, I watched 4, not because I thought it was great, but because I thought that Sofia Vergara was great in the role. I think she's giving a fantastic lead performance. And my feeling on the show itself is that it is really kind of paint by numbers, sort of like mafiosa story. Like it's like Goodfellas, but like she's a woman and it's Miami kind of vibes. Like it's just like, here's the deal. We know this story. We're used to this story. There's something comfortable about the rhythms of the story, even though they're depicting some pretty gross stuff. And there's definitely some flaws, but it all moves fast enough. And she's so charismatic and interesting as a performer in the center of it that I was willing to just keep going with it. And so I kept going and I got to 4 out of 6 episodes. That's my big take on it. I don't think it's a particularly good show, but it's a very like entertaining show in the sort of like, this is familiar and I'm used to this and it's not that bad. It really feels like the thing that Bella Bajaria, who is in charge of Netflix, is content. She's like chief content officer now, I believe is her current title. She promised us this last year, gourmet cheeseburgers. That's what this feels like to me. Josh, what do you think?
I don't disagree with anything you said. I think that Sofia Vergara does a really good job in the lead role. And other than that, it is, yeah, I mean, it's that kind of drug lord story that we've seen many times before. And maybe that's just a genre that I'm not truly a fan of. It's not one that I find myself gravitating towards. I think what got me the most was an almost insulting quality of it. Like just the way it's presented is, what if a drug lord, but it was a woman? It's like this like girl bossification, yeah, of like drug running. It's like, is that really what we needed in 2024? Is that what you're trying to tell us? Like, this is ridiculous. Like
it's like the scene in Elf where, yeah, it's like the two guys who were like, well, what if this? And it's like a terrible variation on it's like, but it's asparagus, but he's, you know, yes, self-conscious about the smell of his pee. And you're just, yes, like, come on. Yeah, I totally get that.
It is girl boss godfather, that is for sure. And that, like, there's parts of that that sucks, but something that I do like about it and I want to stand up for it a little bit, is that we've gotten a lot of shows over the years that are like, you know what, this person, they really believe that they're doing this for the right reasons, and we're going to spend the next 7 years of your life showing why they're wrong and why actually they're terrible until eventually they realize that they're terrible too.
You talk about
that's
Breaking
not what the show is interested in. I'm telling you, there's a lot of shows that fit that. Some of them are great, some of them are not so great. This show does not fit that at all. Now, Griselda as a character will lie to people and say, I'm doing this for the right reason. But you know, and she knows that she's lying. She's doing this because she wants money and power, and she wants to be on top, and she thinks that she's smart enough to do it, and she takes a lot of pride in that, and she's going to do it, and she's going to be brutal and horrible if she has to. She's going to lie and manipulate if she has to. She's going to be just as bad as all the boys, which is very girl boss in a way. It's just like, okay. But it doesn't ever lose track of that as a show, and I did at least respect that as a deviation. It's not trying to make her be a more humanistically interesting person. It very much knows who she is as a historical figure and is not trying to make us kind of create a permission structure for her to do these things, for her to be likable, for her to be like, actually, we didn't really think about it this way, or did you think about it that way? It's not engaging in that sort of discourse at all. And I respected it for that, at least.
I agree. Yeah. Like, we've seen way too many of those type of shows, and after a while that gets tired. But like you were saying, it's just so paint by number. It's like painfully paint by numbers, where it's just like, here she comes. She's into the country. Now she has to go find this guy who doesn't even own a suit, who's going to be her bodyguard. And then he'll rise to the top with her. And here's this. And here's the first boss she's going to meet to do this and do that. And it's just like, I've seen Scarface. I hated Scarface. I think Scarface is a terrible movie. And this isn't terrible. I think, like you said, Alex, Sofia Vergara is so captivating in this role. My favorite part is where she has crouched herself so low holding a baseball bat to knock the shit out of this guy. And she just goes to town on him. And it's just like, she owns every second she's on screen. You cannot help but just watch every little thing she does. She's great. This is like her proving ground to be like, hello, I'm not just the modern family actress. I can do serious drama. Please cast me in your next Oscar-winning movie or Emmy Award-winning thing. I can do this. But I just felt like this was, hey, did you like Narcos? Did you like Scarface? Well, here's the thing.
Yeah, I think that's literally what it is.
Oh, yeah. But I do think when she got to the scene where she confronts, in the first scene where she confronts her husband and everything, where he, you know, forces her to do something pretty heinous, like all the stuff she does with her performance in that, it's just so tremendous. I just wish this was a better show, so people would be like, this is all people are talking about. It's just like, I know it's January, so Emmys are like, you know, people aren't gonna remember this, but like, this is like a tour de force type thing where people are like, you have to see Sofia Vergara in this. Instead, we're just like, hey, it's like Scarface, but you know, with a lady in there, you know, and that's kind of sucks.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that for me, most of the time, I wouldn't even watch a show like this, and I watched it for this podcast. But I'm glad that I did, because I think that her performance is worth seeing on its own. And I think that what's basic about the rest of it is like, it just goes down pretty smooth, even though it's not good. You know, like, there's what you guys haven't seen is that in episode 2, they introduce a whole like police detective subplot where there's this like lady detective who like nobody respects at the force. And then she's a single mom. And like, the actress is really, again, the actress is really good and she's doing the most she can, but it's like the most basic, like bland, like you've seen it a million times stories. And also like, just really just doesn't, like, I don't need to follow the people who eventually take her down. It's like it's a rise and fall crime story. The cops are gonna get her, probably, right? That's like how these things go. I don't need to know about the cops. Like, that's not really what it is. So my big note is basically like, I really wish this was a movie instead of a 6-episode TV show. I think if it was a movie, it would be a lot easier for people to watch, you know, a lot more palatable in terms of like getting people who would be like, I would watch that to see what Sofia Vergara is up to. And I think it would probably be a lot more, I guess, like more effective in the ways in which it needs to be effective, and pitched at the level that this is pitched at. But
I feel like even that would feel like an old school TV movie, which is like, Modern Family Sofia Vergara in a way you've never seen her before.
But like, she
Griselda.
Is better.
No, no, no. She's great. But like, the concept of that. It is just like, yes. The concept I'm talking about. Even if it was, but it was listen, like, tonight on ABC, Sofia Vergara as you've never seen her. She's amazing. I'm not belittling her, but that's what I think
and
the movie
she's
would be.
A producer on this. And I think it's important to think about that because I think like she clearly, I don't think anybody would have cast her in this role. She cast herself in this role. She got this going on her own, and she selected Narcos, which is an incredibly popular brand for Netflix. She got those guys to come on board and do this show with her, and it's a great showcase. It's a great acting showcase, like you said, for what she's capable of doing down the road. She's not just, you know, she's very good at being funny and silly, and she's got great comic timing and stuff, but I didn't know she was capable of this, and now I do, and I think a lot of people are going to be in that position, and I think that's ultimately a good thing, and that's kind of, I think, what it is worth watching for, understanding that it is like a C-plus at best of a TV show.
But on the track record we've had over, you know, it's still very, based on her performance, still better than some of the stuff we've watched. You know, those that run of Amazon sci-fi shows were like, you know, those were bad, but this is not a bad show. It's just, yes, like you said, you've seen it. I wouldn't call it a gourmet cheeseburger. I call it a fast food cheeseburger.
Josh, what kind of cheeseburger is this show? So we can close out on the segment.
I mean, I know cheeseburgers pretty well, guys.
This is like chain restaurant fast food ish like a Red Robin cheeseburger.
So fast casual, we call
fast
that a fast casual
fast casual. There we go.
Fast cash cheese burger. That's what we're dealing with. Yeah,
not related to cheese from Reservation Dogs at all.
No,
we must protect him at all costs.
No, he would not approve. But he would, but I think he would be on my side about respecting the fact that Sofia Vergara is growing as an actress and taking on the opportunity when she could.
She could have done a Netflix rom-com and cashed a check, and she went for the path of most resistance, probably.
Yeah, very easily could have probably been like a supporting character in Heart of Stone, for instance. But instead, she's doing this, and I'm glad she did. She does some pretty messed up stuff on the show. And good for her. Okay, so that's going to do it for us. I hope you found that conversation engaging. I would say if you like these kinds of shows, watch it. If you don't. And watch just maybe like a highlight reel of her performance. Josh thinks you shouldn't watch it, and Bill thinks you shouldn't watch it. So instead, let's talk about things that they think you should do, which is following them other places on Pop Break. So, Josh, where can we follow you? What are you up to?
So people can find me on the Anniversary Brothers podcast, where this month Aaron and I are talking about the, I'm blanking on the number, the 10-year anniversary of the Lego Movie. We actually just recorded that podcast earlier this year.
That's 10 years old already? Oh, my God.
I know. Really, really makes you feel loved.
I was watching that movie, like that and Winter Soldier, because Sophie would be up as a newborn. I'd be watching both of those on Stars, like on repeat all the time. That means she's going to be 10 this year. Oh, Christ. Oh.
She's almost too old to watch the Lego Movie.
Never too old to watch the Lego Movie. I encourage people to listen to that, even if they do have flashbacks to taking care of a newborn. And then people can also find me on the Anime Pop podcast, where every month Amanda Rivas and I talk about the ins and outs of anime. This coming month, we're going to have a very special guest. You might know him as Bill Botkin right here, and he's going to be talking about Avatar The Last Airbender with us. Very excited for that.
The M. Night movie.
So, no.
Which I rented from Netflix on my birthday one year. What a fucking bad birthday that was.
I will rip my eyes out if I have to watch that again.
Okay, well, to save you from the fate of Tom Cruise in Minority Report, we're going to not do that. And instead, I'm going to also briefly mention that you're also going to be, before our audience hears from you again here, you're going to be on Socially Distance talking about the new Avatar TV show as well. So definitely check that out.
Going to be sick of me, people.
Never. I'm going to be going next and say you can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You can follow Bill versus the MCU, which I co-host along with Bill Blanken. This month, we are breaking glass and entering into the X-verse. That's right. It's our Extreme X-Watch Part 1, where we talk about the original X-Men trilogy. I can't wait. This is going to be so fun. It's like really new territory for us after all these years of MCU stuff. We're finally getting acquainted with the mutants as they get ready to enter into the MCU proper. It's going to be a blast. Bill, you can be seen a lot of places recently. Yeah, so why don't you tell us where that is?
I'll put over my guest appearances and thank, because I need to thank those people. I was on the Bob Culture podcast recently, talking with my socially distanced podcast partner, Amanda Rivas, talking about the Royal Rumble. Then we were on the United States Department of Nerds talking about Echo. So you can go check those podcasts out on all your favorite streaming platforms. As for me, I am the co-host of the Socially Distanced podcast, which drops every single Friday on Pop Break and all your favorite streaming platforms. This week, we are Ben Merkison is in the host seat and he's doing a Peaky Blinders episode. So that's going to be a lot of fun. After that, we're going to be talking about our last football podcast for the 2023 season. And then we're in Avatar for 2 weeks. So it's going to be a fun 4 weeks coming up and a lot of stuff for me to watch. So find that out. Of course, Bill versus the MCU, like Alex said, but most importantly, at followthepopbreak.com. We've been doing this 15 years this September. We have lots of stuff there. We're back in concerts. We're doing comic book reviews every Wednesday, all the big films, plus our Oscar podcast is back as well. So go check out thepopbreak.com every single day. Follow us on all forms of social media at the Pop Break, except for YouTube, where we are at popbreak.com, all spelt out. And if you must follow me on X, well, you know, I'm at Bodkin Writes. So Alex, take us home, man.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Thanks, Josh. Thanks, everybody, again, for listening. It's been a blast, as always. Tune in coming up to find out the great show that we're going to be talking about. We're keeping it as a surprise. It's going to be really excited for you guys to find out what it is. And until then, see you next month.